Elements of Corporate Financial Success. This session is sponsored by the Professional Group in Engineering Management of the IEEE, and it is one in a series of efforts on our part to bring home to our membership the realities of the financial world in which we live. The program today is going to concentrate on the meaningfulness of the financial constraints used in the management of a technically oriented company. We're going to approach it through a panel discussion. Each of the men will speak for a few minutes from his own perspective, and then we are specifically interested in a substantial amount of participation on the part of the people in the audience. Our criterion is that we want the interaction to take place as opposed to just have you sit and listen and absorb. And this is the way we will judge the effectiveness of the program. The points of view that are going to be expressed are dealing with companies at different stages of development. Our first speaker is going to talk about problems associated with turnaround situations. Our second speaker will talk about a growing but substantial company and their problems associated with the use of financial controls. And our third speaker will deal with his observations on startup situations, particularly those in the area of interest to us. Our first speaker is Herbert Roth. He's currently President and Chief Executive Officer of the Laboratory for Electronics in Boston. Originally, he was Vice President of GCA Corporation in Bedford. He then went over and became President of Analex Corporation. It's a manufacturer of peripheral equipment for the EDP industry. And after it was merged into Mohawk Data Sciences, he was Chairman of the Executive Committee and continues as a director of the company. Mr. Roth will deal with the problems associated with companies that are in a turnaround status. Mr. Roth.
Thank you, Hugh. What we thought we would do today was a simple program of me starting the discussion by talking about companies specifically two that I dealt with that were in the technological fields and had gotten into trouble as they grew. Take those examples and then discuss the reasons why these people got into trouble. And that would naturally lead into Ben Barth's discussion of financial controls and so on. And following Art Rock talking about the initiation of new ventures. So with that in mind, let me make a few comments. Some people refer to any manager, such as myself, that gets involved in companies that have not gotten a return on the bottom line as a company doctor. I personally abhor the phrase because I really do not believe that adequately describes what you're doing. If they have to have a label, I would prefer to be called a conservationist, because what I really believe that the major interest is taking a situation that does have resources and realigning the resources into a more meaningful attack on the markets that they serve. But if we have to use the terms company doctor, let's stick with a couple of medical terms. The first case I will give you is a company that in time became a mental case. The second company that I will talk about in time became allergic to itself. And as quickly as it developed some resources, it would make other moves that would trump the resources right out of existence. So let's talk about the two cases. Their business environment and their product lines and their management problems. In the first case, we have a company that had a fine product line that over the years had assumed more and more importance to the marketplace along a very narrow line. And this was, and I will not try to disguise it because people know what I am talking about, and this was Analex, which was in the high-speed printer business. And through the development of the EDP market, became a major supplier to almost all of the major mainframe producers and a source for their high-speed printers. Through the years, it enjoyed considerable success, but as time went on, more and more of the mainframe producers started to make their own product, so that there was always this buildup of volume with a given customer, and when the customer reached a volume that made sense for him to gear up and do the job himself and get more contributed value into his system, he did so. This, of course, posed a very special problem for the management of the company, in the sense that over the long term, you either had to satisfy yourself with one product, serving customers who the healthier they got and the wealthier they got, the less opportunity you would have to serve them beyond that. How do you diversify, or what should be your management tact, your strategy? Analex got into trouble because it did not have a long-range strategy that looked at the market that it served and decided what its long-term survival would be and where it would make its money. It only reacted as more and more people left its fold as they started up themselves. And this put it in a situation where as business got better, it got worse. Now, the situation of the company when I joined it was pretty fundamental and fundamentally bad. It was out of money because it had no cash flow over the past 2 or 3 years that were feeding new areas of survival. It had failed to plan its financing so that even though business was reasonably good, it was in no position to attempt areas of diversification or to do anything to modify its dependence on an OEM market. It did not examine the fundamental concepts that are open to a management in technology today, such things as should it sell or lease, should it depend on OEMs or try to attack the direct user, should it be a one product or a multi-product company, and if it decides on the high-risk course of one product, will it constantly develop the return on investment that will allow it to put sufficient funds back into new areas of improvement to its product or new techniques that will continue to force its limited family of customers to depend on it. So it developed a credibility gap. A credibility gap with the bankers because they recognized that there was poor financial management. It developed a credibility gap with the customers because as it got into trouble, it was rendering them poor service in the form of delivery, of developing capacity to meet their expanding requirements, and to a limited extent, suffering quality problems, because when you have financial problems, I think quality problems generally follow right in line. It developed a credibility gap with its vendors because it couldn't pay them on time and therefore couldn't get deliveries on time. And it developed a credibility gap with its stockholders because the stock price as a result of the performance dropped considerably. And the end result of that, of course, is that the company lost its latitude to correct itself through new financing or through acquisitions, which in turn could diversify its product line. These are all elements that I think a lot of people do not pay sufficient attention to the interrelationship between these elements. And I think it's incumbent on the managers of successful companies to continually revise, develop, and revise their long-range plans to ensure that they don't miss an opportunity. If your stock price is up, it opens avenues of new financial resources. It opens avenues of diversification through acquisition. If your financing is good in the basic plan, you'll gain the confidence of further financing from the financial community because they then have a feeling that you know how to utilize the funds they make available to you. The second case of a business environment that we will briefly discuss is the company that I joined last year and am presently with, and what were its problems, and what kind of environment was it in? Well, LFE has a combination of divisions. Last year we had five, and within these divisions, believe it or not, we had about 14 to 15 different businesses that we were in. So it had a big turnover, sales turnover, in relation to its basic debt, so that the big white hope on everybody's part was the fact that if you could only take better than $50 million in sales and make just an average return on sales, you would have a nice profitable base to work from. You would have good debt service capability. And for the Wall Street analyst, if you could get a reasonable return on sales and spread it over our 1,300,000 shares, the earnings per share would look pretty handsome and in turn make the stock price reasonably handsome. The debt service, however, though the company is in good financial condition, the ability to debt service began to come into question last year as a result of significant losses five out of the previous 6 years, culminating in the loss we posted in April of 1968 of almost $5 million. So that what was a comfortable situation, and without talking out of school, I can recall talking to the major banker 6 months before I came to the company, when I was initiating an investigation of it and looking into its possibilities in a business fashion over and above the rumors that I would hear having lived in the area in which the company operated. The banker said, any bank in town would lend these people money. There's no financial crisis whatsoever. And the same banker, when I sat down with him 2 weeks after I was in the company, stated his great concern about what we were going to do to be able to service the debt that we were creating, and he was had on his desk the previous management's prognostication of the next year in which we were going to be utilizing considerable additional debt. So that as the company got in trouble, its ability to debt service came into question, which in turn began to erode the confidence of the financial community to support the company. It had good products, and it was diversified as opposed to our first case, wherein we had one product and really a very small number of customers because we were selling to the OEMs and not selling to the general marketplace. The LFE had some areas of activity that had tremendous potential, and then they had the second class, and I think this is important when we weigh what business we're in and what we're doing. It had a second class of problems of businesses that had no potential, and it had a third class of businesses where success would kill us because we could still go ahead and achieve success on our development programs. And the development programs were geared into certain areas that even if we came up with a fine end product, we would be faced with an immediate problem of how could we get it to the marketplace without expending an additional effort, an additional amount of funds. In other cases, we had development programs going on that were totally oblivious to what was going on in the marketplace and the changes because the programs had been allowed to run over that critical period of time that people should program for development programs, wherein either you have to have success or you're at grave risk because the technology in the marketplace will begin to evolve to pass you by. And there was no cognizance of this fact because there were little in the line of management controls and assessments of what we were doing. In other cases, we had an imbalance of development money. The division that had the smallest opportunity for success, even if its programs were successful in the development sense, that division was expending the most amount of development money, and the division that had the greatest opportunity for growth, market penetration, return on investment, and return on sales was spending the least. So that here, as you looked at the diversified nature of the company and its inherent need for structuring programs to serve each of its markets that it was going into or was serving well, there was no assessment as to the total balance that can be brought and where can you put the dollar that's going to reap the greatest return. So these are the business environments of what the two companies were in. Then you can talk about the management environments. One thing that always comes to my mind when I join a company that has been in trouble and I look at the group of people with whom I'm going to work, I say to myself, how good are these people? Because if they are good, why have they been content to live with a loser and not either do something about it or leave it? And I think it's something that we all should think about in our normal day-to-day effort is as we look at individual departments that are winners or losers, when you look at the losers, what about those people that are content to live with losers? A lot of times they will tell you that due to the very top management, they could not exercise the discretion in their own management areas that they felt they could, they were able to do. And I'll buy that. I think that this is true to a limited extent. I think if the man at the very top is not exercising sound business practice, it will inhibit good people right down the line. And it's pretty hard to get a shining star four levels from the top if the top isn't going to permit that, create an environment that will permit that. As a result, management controls, which we'll hear more about, come into question. And again, we talk about something that I just mentioned, the balance of the way we spend our funds, the balance of the way we approach the marketplace, and where can we make a good return with what resources we have. Then we can tie closely to these management controls. Of course, the best management controls and administrative systems in the world do not make profits. People make profits. Smart people that come up with new products, smart people that know how to develop the strategies that will reap the return on these new products. And I've never known an administrative system that will supplant the people that make these businesses tick. So in our technology, we have to create an environment that will give people an opportunity to bring forth the kind of resources on which we can play. We have to match that with our ability to get to the market. And in too many cases, either on companies that I've been directly involved with or either as an officer or as a director, or in cases where we're just sitting at a lunchtime with a business associate and listen to his approach, in too many cases, I see a lack of appreciation as to what is the end result of what we're doing. That if we have a development program that is going to be successful, what are we going to do to bring that product to the marketplace, and can we? Now, this is the problem I faced with Analyx. We had a fine printer. We were in the OEM business. The OEM business was good business, and we were doing 20% better than we did the year before. The next year looked like we could add another 30% or 20%. But on the other hand, we were getting a squeeze from the very nature of the market that we were in because we were selling to few customers who in turn appreciated our position, and we were getting increased competition. We had to shift our mode of operation from selling to the OEM to going direct. What do you do in that case, and how do you take this fine product and go direct with it? Well, all I could see was that for the next 5 years, I would be explaining to my stockholders that there were no profits this year because we have a tremendous increasing investment in marketing whereas before we had no profits because we weren't running ourselves efficiently, and so on and so forth. I believe that people have to get their returns now, and that they are looking for returns now, and a management that cannot give them returns now but is always looking to the future is putting them at great risk. So we examined the various alternatives, and the alternative that suited best was to merge it with Mohawk Data, because Mohawk had a fine organization out in the field selling equipment. They were also able to support a good-sized leasing program, and the combination of these two advantages gave us an alternative of getting together, going to the direct user, going to them not just to sell but to lease, and offering a greater opportunity. Today, if you were in the Mohawk organization, you'd find that the Analex output has been doubled just in the last year and a half because of the change in the mode of being able to go direct to the end user, and they're doing it the way it should be done, and they're not looking 3 years out for their return. They're getting their return in short order. So there's this business of matching the technological capability of the company with the marketing capability of the company, and in turn you'll never get a match unless you've got the financial controls that are going to examine, pinpoint where your areas of opportunity are and how do you capitalize on them. In the last week, I went through the same thing at LFE in the Automatic Signal Division, where we talk about the business of funding traffic systems and how do we match our technological capability, which is the finest in the business, with capturing an ever greater portion of the marketplace. And believe it or not, it really comes down to our ability to finance, in the sense of showing the communities initially how to best utilize the matching funds they're getting. Secondly, to overcome any future problems that they may face on being able to support themselves through bond issues, because as we're seeing, it's a pretty wild market that's developing in the financial picture. So that we have to look ahead here. We are looking ahead at Europe in the same way, that can we go to lease systems? Can we, if we aren't going to lease systems, are we going to make sure they know how to get the funding? And if we have to go to lease system, where are we going to get the funds to do so? So these are touching then on the external market environment. You've got your own problems inside, but you've also got to be aware of the financial problems in the general economy. We're seeing high interest rates. High interest rates in themselves really have not perturbed any plans we have. On the other hand, what follows the high interest rates may be a dry up of money, and being that we don't consider ourselves any General Motors, we know that the blue chip companies are going to get the bank support first, and then all the rest of us common folk are going to line up at the window after that. So that we have to be aware of the external environment that our business is operating in. The next part of my summary here will be what does one do given these different general environments that these two businesses were in, and a brief summary of some of the detail of the problems they were in. What does one do to initiate a change in the fortunes of the business venture? And I'd like to enumerate in each case what was done and let you draw your own conclusions as to whether you agree or disagree, or maybe you would have done it differently. But I'll just enumerate the historical part of it. In Analex, Analex, when I went there, was virtually bankrupt. There was a question as to whether it was going to be Chapter 10 or 11, I think, in the minds of some of the people that were in the Boston financial community. It got that way through the various things that I had talked about before. But the crux of the issue was that it had a capability of generating cash if you eliminated all the sideshows that it was involved in. such as a disk file development program that had been going on past that critical period of time that I mentioned earlier, wherein technology will pass you by if you're not out in the marketplace at that scheduled period. And we were developing a disk file that was a year away from the marketplace, but already 2 years behind the economics of the marketplace and the performance specifications of competitive equipments that were already in the marketplace. This had drained something like $3.5 million and was still draining heavily. So we cut that off. There was no question about should we be in a disk file business or not. The survival of the business stated that even if we had something that was going to be all right in the marketplace, we couldn't afford to fund it to get there because any further drain was going to put us in bankruptcy, literally. The second thing was that we had a financial crisis in the sense that the banks were at their limit. One bank literally had its legal lending limit, and it brought another bank in. So we had about $5.5 million in overdue debt, and in addition to a couple million dollars of term debt. And when you're starting to get a company that's only $17, $18 million in total volume, you're starting to furnish some serious problems because the debt service capability had been dwindled by the switchover of things like one of the most profitable contracts that Analex had with both GE and RCA buying complete printers from them. And the year before this all started the downgrade, one of the problems was the fact that they said, we'll now only buy the print head, and we will supply our own electronics. And, of course, we lost a whopping big portion of contributed value. The management also priced the price of the print head wrong. You had a $20,000, $30,000 device of which the print head was the crucial and the proprietary item in it. There's nobody in this audience that would get me to sell it for what it was being sold for because you've got to protect what you can add and no one else can take away from you. And so instead of selling a $20,000, $30,000 device, they were finding themselves selling print heads, $9,000, $10,000, $11,000, $12,000, and the rest being made by these people. So that the wrong decision was made. And this we could not reverse because we had lost then a good profit contribution in the form of the electronic body of the device. So we had to live with that. On the other hand, we had a unique situation in the sense that the customer, like it or not, was totally dependent on us because without us shipping printers, he wasn't going to ship computer systems. And for him to start a new pipeline had a sizable delay in response, starting up with a competitor and getting his equipment in the line, so that this did offer us certain bargaining opportunities, which proved to be stabilizing to the company. So we took advantage of the situation where we were in a position of having some bargaining power with our customers. Now, then the next thing was to just improve the management controls of knowing where we spent money and knowing where we needn't spend money. And this was straightforward, and I won't bore you with the common axiom that you don't spend money where you don't have to. But believe it or not, a lot of the companies do. There were no controls, in other words, on the simple aspects and straightforward aspects of the business. So we eliminated that. The big thing that we did was said, what business are we in and how are we going to make a dollar at it? And the business that we were in was printing, not disk files, not communications, not anything else. And so, therefore, let's get out of those businesses. They cost us money and we're not making a return on it. So we got out of them. And we restored the health of the company and things progressed very satisfactorily. We never borrowed another dollar from the bank at all. And we came out of it. Lastly, I think, and it's important again, it sounds kind of trite, through a teamwork of people believing again that they had a business that could succeed, and don't underrate that even when you talk about financial controls. In LFE, we've done the same kind of a problem, or we faced the same kind of a problem as I briefly described. We were in too many businesses, though, instead of being in one real business and trying to get into a couple as we were at Analex. Some of these businesses were the type of thing that they really weren't significant in their marketplace. They were profitable. If they had a real good year, they could yield a few bucks of profit. If they had anything less than a real good year, you could lose your shirt on them. Now, those are bum risks. So let's let somebody else have the opportunity to take that gamble, and we peel those off and mated them in most cases with people that were better suited to make good money because they were already significant operators in the markets that these businesses were trying to probe. So we took a business that was an insignificant operator while with us and appended it to a significant operator who bought it, and he, of course, will get greater leverage on the base of that business. In other cases, we just plumb closed down operations and said win, lose, or draw, and most of the time it really wasn't too hard a decision. When you look at a business that been around for 6-7 years and it's been all development, never sold anything, and it's constantly changed the specs on what it's coming out with, that's no problem to close it down. Then in other cases, we had the opposite problem. Not what we shouldn't be in, but what are we in business for? And this, I think, is the essential that anybody that talks about financial controls in a business must come to grips with. And that's really all the controls in the world aren't worth a hoot if you do not know in your own mind what you're in business for. And this I like to call establishing your vital interest. Now, your vital interests are, one, what you want to be into, where you have the greatest capability and where you have the greatest know-how. Two is, what do you have going for you in the marketplace that says if you realize all this capability in the technological sense, how do you translate of getting it out into the marketplace? And then a third aspect of it, when you're full of vim and vigor and you think you've got the best thing in the world, look around at the world outside and say, what's the nature of my competition? Because if your competition is such that what you think you have going for you stands on the toes of the most powerful guy in that marketplace, maybe he just won't allow you to come in and take away any significant business from him. Maybe he can't allow you to do so. And when you start to talk about things like one of the arguments I had with our people in the memory systems, was the fact that be careful now, because there are a lot of people in this world that their sole source of income is from memory systems, and you people have two things not going for you. One is none of you have competed in that marketplace at the real apex of any organization, so therefore you don't know the rubs of competing in that marketplace. And the second thing is that even if you're successful, how can you expect in your limited way to know enough to compete with that guy that's been out in the rubs of the marketplace, and he knows the nuances of selling in that marketplace. So you might technically succeed, but in a business sense, fail. So we establish then vital interest in the company. And if you establish vital interest and say, what am I in business for, this will overcome that problem that I talked to you earlier about. And that's the part of how do you strike a balance on where you spend your resources and how do you bring your resources into play. At LFE, we very simply stated that we had a division in the traffic equipment business. That market is probably one of the finest markets of the 1970s. It offers great opportunity, and we happen to have the best talent that's in the business today, depth in traffic engineering. So that should receive the greatest support from any ability internally to generate money to be spent on product development, technological resource. Then we had another division that its greatest romance is the fact that it's a good, stable business that can generate good cash, that can permit us to have latitude to operate in some of the more glamorous markets. Then we had another division that has potential in the process control business. It's already in it and doing well in the narrow areas that it's in, and has opportunity for expansion. So it's in the kind of young but growing category. Then we had another division that's in the military electronics business that had back in 1959, 1960, it had a happening. It got a contract that really made the company. Yet, I go back to one of the opening comments I made when I said, in this case, we're kind of allergic to ourselves. While we were reaping the benefits of this technological advance, of the lucrative government contract we had, of a big market where, in effect, the business developed into almost $200 million over a 4 or 5 year spread. The profits generated by that business were not wisely invested in the future of that very division. Not that they all had to go there, but the business itself that was generating success was not being fed an opportunity to regenerate itself with time, so that you had a golden goose and you cut its wings off. And then we had another division that was in the medical x-ray business. And when I looked at the structure of the marketplace, here again, I said we've got some things that are fundamentally wrong here. One, we shouldn't be in this business because we don't know enough about it. And two, we got an inadequate product line to support a national selling organization. So we went out and we found ourselves a European partner that was not selling in the United States, which is 55% of the world market. He needed to get into here. He had a complementary product line, and he had funds that he was willing to invest. And we've mated the two together, and so far, so good, and we'll look ahead from here. So that, in effect, it took us out of the business other than being an investor, and we still manufacture the products we had been manufacturing in the past. But over the next 2 or 3 years, the company will go through a sizable evolution into what we hope will be a significant contributor to the marketplace that it was in, as opposed to the past where it was an insignificant contributor. And that's one of the fundamental topics about what's on the bottom line that I firmly believe in, and that is that if you cannot be significant in any marketplace, then don't be there at all, because all you're doing is going to get put under somebody's heel. They will not permit you the latitude to make good leverage on the base that you're investing in. So I think then the thing that I will attribute the greatest opportunity to operate a business on is establishing these vital interests that I've outlined here, where you look at your business, you establish what you're there for and what your opportunities both inside and outside, and you peel off everything else. And as a result of that, we have peeled off many different operations. And we have, as I mentioned, put them in either homes where they can do better or eliminated them. And as a result, here again, we are not leaning on financial resources for further support to any degree, other than that has been necessary due to the improved business and the growth of the business, wherein we are generating a greater amount of receivables because the velocity of something like our traffic signal business is moving with great strides. So these are the general environments that cause certain responses from me in the financial control sense and in the financial management sense. And I have purposely then just sketched out what these environments were, what some of the problems were, how we attack some of the problems, and I will leave with you your own judgments as to whether you agree that some of these simple concepts that I have outlined are of as paramount importance as I think they are, and secondly, whether you yourself disagree that those are the essential things about taking a business that is not doing well and making it into something that is doing well, you tell me then what you feel are the essential ingredients, and maybe I've, as they used to say about Chamberlain's famous comment, maybe I missed the bus. With that, I'll conclude my comments, and thank you very much.
Well, we are certainly off to a good start for this morning's meeting. Thank you very much, Herb. I'm sure that you all agree this is an approach that lends itself to discussion between the members of the panel and the audience, and we'll get to that after all of the speakers are finished. From the point of view of a company that is in dire need of attention, we are now going to shift to a substantial company that is growing at a very respectable rate, but whose problems are substantially different by virtue of its method of operation. Our next speaker is Mr. Benjamin Barth, who's Vice President Finance of Conrac Corporation. Conrac was formerly known as G&E Controls. It currently consists of about 9 operating divisions and has annual sales in excess of $50 million. Mr. Barth graduated from Rutgers University. He's a certified public accountant. He's a member of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and also of the California and New Jersey CPA societies. Mr. Barth.
Thank you, Hugh. Actually, our corporation purpose as a public company is to provide our owners with continuous growth of earnings on their equity. This is why we're in business. We've got public ownership, and we've got to provide a return for them in terms of a healthy, growing company. We try to make this a reasonably steady record as evidence of dependable managed growth. Now, until 1968, over a 10-year period, Conrac Corporation has averaged approximately 20% annual growth in sales and earnings. Now, this kind of growth cannot be generated indefinitely by a single product line or in a single market or in a single division. From the examples that you've heard, you've seen what has happened to a company that has depended upon a single product line. Now, at a point in time, every growth curve for a particular product line usually has a top, and every market a saturation point where one looks forward at best to the growth rate of the economy as a whole. And you build up to a certain point, and you've exploited that growth, then something else must come along. Not all product lines or all divisions in a company can grow at the same rate. In our company, out of 9 operating divisions, we've had 5 different divisions as number one in terms of sales growth in the last 5 years. Now, what is our strategy in the company in order to maintain this growth? Number one, we must search out markets which are experiencing or about to experience exceptional growth. I don't mean the 6 or 7%. It's got to be 30 or 40% as we see it. We then will attack these markets with a planned, concentrated effort. And what's important is we must try to be a major force in this arena. We can't go in nipping at somebody's heels. We've got to take a position and be a major force in that area. Now, timing is most important. We've got to decide on the proper program and make sure that the product sale, the product that we're developing or coming out with, comes out on time. And we've also got to be able to build it at the right price. Number one, to sell, and number two, to make money on. Now, this can be a very costly effort, and it's not easy, but the payoff has to be high enough to warrant the risks. Now, we've got to do this to sustain and continue a company's growth at a profit. However, they don't all work out as planned. Now, I've used 2 cases at Conrac Corporation because we have the same problems that all companies have, in that we have to provide for growth, and we have to provide for profitable growth. Now, the cases, I'd like to cite the two cases in our company, one which I call a costly development, which means it costs us a heck of a lot more than we had planned, and this is in the numerical control machine tool area. Things did not go as planned, and I'll discuss the reasons for this and the results. And the second case will be a successful development, which is our development of the data display terminal in the computer peripheral field, where this actually came out very timely and resulted in actually better performance than we had planned. Now, as far as the numerical control machine tools, our Datex division had been building a proprietary line of numerical control systems since 1959, for both analytical instruments and machine tools. And until 1965, these controls were generally applied as accessories to standard tools or were assembled into custom tools or systems built by several joint venture partners. These were either two bending companies to whom we sold the controls or tube bending companies and other types of companies from whom we bought the machines and put the controls on. It was apparent that the major machine tool companies had also begun developing their own numerical control capabilities, and that customers usually did not want, when they bought from us, separate organizations responsible for both the controls and the tools. We could see our control business leveling off, even though the whole numerical control machine tool markets were expected to have phenomenal growth. So early in 64, based upon extensive analysis of the market, Department of Commerce industry reports, trade association reports, customer surveys, our own talking to engineers and machine tool companies and users, we estimated that the numerical control machine tool market of all types, these are cutting tools, would grow from under $50 million in 1960 to $2 billion in 1975. We were able to substantiate this, and that these came from a number of sources, and that approximately 50% of all the machine tools would be numerical control in 1975 versus under 1 or 2% in 1960. Now, from 1960 to 1967, cutting tool shipments only, these are cutting tool shipments only, of numerically controlled machine tools were growing at a 30% rate. This is from 60 to 67, whereas the manual tools were growing at a rate of 13% a year. We believe that we could develop into a dominant factor in the numerical control machine tool part of the market by, one, going after special applications. Here is where the volume was relatively small so that we wouldn't be bucking heads with the manufacturers of boring mills, lathes, drills. In other words, we didn't want to compete with Cincinnati Milling, Conning and Trecker, or many of the other companies. We wanted to utilize the advanced control techniques. These are numerical controls which we had developed over the years in our Datex division and which gave us the flexibility to adapt these controls to the machines. Thirdly, we had no built-in inhibitions about change or previous tool design so that we could sell completely new concepts, we can sell completely new ideas, and we went out and did this. We proposed and we booked. We booked numerical control riveting machines on the aircraft programs. We booked honeycomb milling machines, and somewhat later, a new type of boron tape-laying machine in a development stage. Now, the backlog was great. This was all brand-new business. And before going into the decision to do this, we felt that the payoff would be very great. But what happened was that these turned out to be almost straight development jobs insofar as the machines were concerned. Because heretofore, we had been building the controls, and we were building two benders, wire processors, which we knew. Now we went into the esoteric machines where there were no competition at all, and we took on too much. Now, what went wrong? Number one, our expertise was mainly in the controls that we had been manufacturing and that we had been developing. We knew that we wanted the machine to do. We knew how to design it, but we didn't know how to build it ourselves. We didn't know all the tricks that years of experience developed. Thirdly, we put too much reliance on outside plants to build the machines. This is what we had been doing formerly. We had been having the machines built on the outside, and we found that the people on the outside couldn't build these machines. We had to have engineers working with them, and finally we made the decision to build the machines ourselves. We had to develop an organization to handle this. This included quality control, the actual engineering, product engineering, manufacturing, all the items that you're familiar with, because we weren't really in this business in a big way. We underestimated the cost of mating controls to the machine. We estimated the cost of the machine pretty well. We estimated the cost of the controls pretty well. But it costs money to put these two together and get them working as a whole unit. This was expensive. We underestimated installation costs. When these machines got out to the customer, they had to be installed and they had to be put into working order. And all of this was on a fixed price, which is how you have to deal primarily with this type of business. Now, what actually happened is we had four development jobs going through this division at one time, and we couldn't do them justice. From a dollars and cents point of view, and I tell you this because it's public information, we refer to this in our 68 annual reports, that the development costs on this program exceeded our original estimates in production and installation phases by $300,000 in 1967 and by $1,300,000 in 1968. However, and I advise all of you to follow this, write off your losses as soon as you know about them. We do this as we go along. All losses are behind us, and this division is now profitable. These machines are being installed and are working properly, but they're all late, and we're still in the process of shipping some of them out. Now, we consider this, in retrospect, to be a good investment because the market is big. It's a gigantic market. We have carved out a place for us. Admittedly, it's cost us a great deal more money than we had anticipated. We tried to take on too many development jobs at one time, but if we can do, say, for example, in 1 year, $10 million at 5%, then we will have bought into a business at approximately 3 or 4 times earnings, and that isn't hard to take. We think that the long-time results will pay off. Now, the second case that I'd like to discuss with you is the one at our Conrac division, and this is a development of a data display terminal. In 1964, our Conrac division, which is engaged in the manufacture of black and white and color monitors for the broadcast industry, for closed circuit TV, such as education and other control purposes, projected its volume in color for the next 5 years. Could you show that number two, please? Actually, I've taken the dollar scale off, but as you can see, we have a build-up from 1964. These are color monitors, which we started building in 1964, and we did what Mr. Ross says. We looked ahead, And as you see, there's a bell curve with the sales peaking out in 1966, 1967, and then starting to fall off in 1968. This is in dollars. Now, we felt at that time that we ought to be looking at another growth market. And we decided to develop another product line to provide growth and offset this projected loss of the color monitors. In 1965, the computer peripheral field attracted our attention. You want to flip that off, please? And we commissioned a research firm to do a market study for us, and it was apparent that the cathode ray tube display would be a very important part of the computer peripheral market. And we took a look at the growth in a five-year period, and we found out that total display devices would go from some $100 million in 1966 to an estimated $350 million in 1971, or a growth curve of 28%. But of this total display, and the CRT displays would go from $30 million to $250 million, or over a 40% annual growth over a five-year period. Now, since we were already in the cathode ray tube business, this was a natural for us, and we decided in 1966 to go ahead with a development program in order to define the type of unit that we wanted to build, what we wanted it to do, and this program went very, very well. Actually, in the first quarter of 1968, will you show that, please? Just put that on top. Let's take that off for a minute. Wait. Just take it off. Actually, as you can see, based upon the survey, the alphanumeric or display part of this is the red line at the bottom of the scale, and this is how we projected that to come in and offset the loss of volume of our, more than offset the loss of our volume in our color monitor business. Now, actually, here's what happened. The bars, the blue bars that you see, are our actual sales of color monitors. In other words, we sold more. We did a poor job of planning here because we sold more in 1966, and the color business started to fall off. It peaked in 66 and started to fall off in 1967. And you see the results here. We had two very big years. And in 68, the color business fell off. Those are annual rates, the blue bars that you see there, fell off. And this is one of the things that did hurt us in 1968. The data display terminals or alphanumeric business did not come along fast enough. Now, we couldn't get it into production fast enough. Actually, in the first quarter of 1968, we booked a $7 million order with the Burroughs Company. I tell you, this is public information, with the Burroughs Corporation, who had been manufacturing these type of equipments themselves, but we gave them what they needed, we gave them price, and we gave them a good product. And they found it more expedient to buy from us than to continue manufacturing these items themselves. We got these units into production in the fourth quarter of 1968, and this will be building up during 1969. In the first quarter of 1969, we booked a second order from another computer manufacturer in the same product line. Now, we had... You want to take that off? Now, we had also previously made a decision to sell this on an OEM basis. We didn't have the staff to sell the user. We didn't have the service capability to deal with hundreds of users throughout the country. And we knew the OEM business because this is how we sold color monitors and black and white monitors. And this has been working out very successfully because other computer mainframe houses are now looking at this particular product. Now, why did this particular program go well? Number one, we had very capable people generally familiar with the product technology. You see, they knew how to build these items. We didn't know this in the machine tool business. In this division, this was the one major new development so that we could make effective use of people. In other words, we took the best talent we had, the creative people in here, and we put them to work on this particular product line. This worked. We monitored the program, and it went well. Furthermore, we had a facility, and we had trained people. These were assembly people who could work at this, people with the expertise. And fourthly, we had good control. In conclusion, running a business is an extremely difficult task. Nothing is static. If a business becomes static, it starts to fall off, and we stop the growth curve. I've covered our business philosophy, which is applicable to any company, whether large or small. It isn't easy to search out a market which will grow at a fast rate, which you can go after in a planned and concentrated effort. It can be an expensive program. We learned this in 1968, but the payoff is there. Actually, both programs, we did our market survey work well. The market is there in both of these product lines, and we expect the payoff in machine tools to come about in 1969 and future years.